This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662. Or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is once again time for a weekly Q&A with Layla. And as summer wanes, you need to check in for your weekly dose of health information. Many people do. They like this segment. It's an opportunity to pose questions about medicine and health and nutrition. You can email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And as usual, I'm accompanied by Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, who possesses a master's degree in the field of nutrition as well as being a registered dietitian. Hi, Layla. How are you?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you doing?
Good, good. We, I think, can get directly to questions because we're kind of in a Labor Day lull here. Things haven't quite settled down after the official end of summer, although the temperatures are kind of sticking around. Yeah. So let's take some questions.
Yeah. The end of summer once again. Okay.
Yeah.
We've got a question here from Larry. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I know that you've covered eggs before, but I just got this in my mailbox. Can we talk about eggs again? It's only talking about eggs, mm-hmm. not the extras that go along with it. And this is actually from a Dr. Michael Greger from nutritionfacts.org.
Okay, so he got it in his mailbox. They used to throw eggs at my house when I was a kid. And they used to put toilet paper in my house. So they put eggs in his mailbox? That's not very nice.
Oh, no, eggs in his mailbox, exactly.
No, so he gets he gets some kind of health letter, right?
Right, from nutritionfacts.org.
And nutritionfacts.org, if I'm not mistaken, it's a very popular website, but it's primary...
Yeah.
Focus is on plant-based nutrition, vegetarianism, if not outright veganism. He's very popular. There's a lot of I've looked at his website on not his website but his Facebook page. He has a lot of followers, and uniformly mm-hmm. he puts out information that discourages people from eating meat, dairy and fish, mm-hmm. And eggs are on the bad list too. Okay.
Right.
But let's take a look at the merits of that claim. Okay. So what does it say?
Well, it's actually a video and that eggs can cause diabetes.
Okay.
Now, unfortunately, what they basically did is they looked at populations of people who eat eggs, but they did not factor in anything that goes along with the eggs, the home fries or the French fries, the toast, mm-hmm. the juice,
right.
a sugary cup of coffee possibly, any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he draws this conclusion that eggs can cause diabetes. Now, of course, we beg to differ with him.
Right.
Because diabetes, type 2,
right.
is defined as a condition of carbohydrate intolerance.
Right.
The lonely little egg only has a half a gram of carbs in it.
Yes.
But check your toast, check your home fries...
Right.
Check your juice.
And this is one of these things where, these very, very hard to do these nutritional studies because they may ask on a questionnaire, how many eggs do you eat per week? And then they correlate it with the whatever condition they're looking at, heart disease or diabetes.
Right.
But there may be some other factors that they're not accounting for. So, for example, you could say, well, people who drive, Ford F-150s, because they drive Ford F-150s, they have more heart attacks or diabetes and more obesity. But it may not be the fact they drive Ford F-150s. It may be just that's the kind of population where, they also go to the International House of Pancakes and,
right.
scarf down a big stack of pancakes every morning.
With lots of maple syrup.
Yeah. Yeehaw. Okay. So I did a little search on this, and actually, you know, I have to say there is a study that correlates intake of eggs with diabetes, higher risk of diabetes in that study. And of course, this guy who is kind of a ideologue seized upon that study to demonstrate how bad eggs were for you. But the research on this is confusing and mostly comes down on the side of eggs having a protective effect against diabetes. And I'm referencing a study that was done, I believe, in 2015, last year, in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, which we respect. And the study looked at 2,332 Finnish men between the ages of 42 and 60. They were initially evaluated in the 1980s, and then it's a long-term study. 4 years later, then 11 years later, and 20 years later, they were revisited. And they found that of this roughly 2,300 men, 432 men developed type 2 diabetes. Those who initially consumed the most eggs were found to be 38% less likely to develop diabetes than those who consumed the least eggs in that study. And a difference between eating an average of 4 eggs versus less than 1 egg per week. And then they did some controlling for physical activity levels, overweight, smoking, because maybe, you know, some people who eat eggs maybe smoke more or, you know, because vegetarians generally vegetarians are careful people. And one thing you can say about vegetarianism is that usually it's associated with a generally healthier lifestyle, and vegetarians just consume less calories, and so there may be an advantage there. However, they said there was no benefit accrued from eating more than 4 eggs per week. In other words, it wasn't harmful, but it wasn't like, oh, wow, eggs are good. Let me eat, you know, two dozen eggs a week. But that didn't appear to be harmful. They said that they don't know why there was a benefit, but the benefits of egg consumption could be due to nutrients contained in eggs that affect glucose metabolism and reduce inflammation.
Go ahead. No, I was going to just name some of the nutrients in the wonderful egg.
Yes.
The perfect protein. You know, the white of the egg has some B vitamins, which is just fine. The yolk has some vitamin A, lutein, zeaxanthin, choline, smaller amounts of vitamin D, some omega-3s. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's like a perfect food. So,
but just to share with you the nature of these studies and how they sometimes don't shed light on a controversy, you know, like a basic question, should I eat eggs or not? Are eggs good for you or eggs bad for you? I'm reading here that in 2008, a study published in the journal Diabetes Care found that greater egg consumption was associated with a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes in both men and women. Now, that's notwithstanding that 7 years later, in 2015, it showed a 38% reduction. However, there was another study that was presented in 2014 that found that among people with type 2 diabetes, a diet rich in eggs led to more lasting fullness and reduced food cravings while having no negative effect on blood cholesterol.
True that the cholesterol in our foods, it only contributes maybe 10 to 20% of the cholesterol in our blood. It's mostly the liver because we need our cholesterol. Mm-hmm. That's really the other thing. And such a downfall of these studies is they're taking the egg and looking at it without giving it the context of what type of a diet is the person following.
Right.
Because that's everything else, you know, and that's everything, if you ask me.
Right. Yeah, and it's just hard to do these nutritional studies. But, you know, the expression, the devil can quote scriptures to his favor. I think that's in the Bible, somewhere. And that's the nature of that's the nature of nutritional literature. You know, when I was a dedicated vegan vegetarian back in the 1980s, and I changed that by the early 90s, I had started to modify that more towards a Mediterranean diet and then towards now a paleo diet. I could quote a lot of studies and statistics that suggested that vegetarianism was the answer to virtually everything, that it was the way to go. But that was because I was ideologically driven. And, you know, so I'm aware of that way that ideological bias can creep in and shape your scientific conclusions.
And you know what else? Whatever our hypothesis or whatever we lean towards in terms of what is best in terms of diet, there's a scientific study out there to support it.
Yep.
The China study.
Yep.
All of that was cherry-picked.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody just goes, you can say anything you want, because there will be, you will find at least one bit of scientific research
mm-hmm.
to support that. Now, is that scientific research any good?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to look at that, too. You have to look at that, too.
It's kind of like politics and religion.
You know? Yeah.
It's like you could take virtually any position and defend it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Larry, eat your eggs.
Yep, go ahead and eat your eggs. Don't
fine.
Worry about it. Don't worry about it.
Make sure they're organic, always.
Yep, that's even
yeah.
better.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
So let's move on to our next question.
We've got a question here from Michael. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Should somebody who takes MK7, would they benefit from also taking natokinase, or would it be redundant?
It depends on what
yeah.
for. You know, MK7 is something that is helpful for reducing atherosclerosis, but I use natokinase in people who are at high risk for stroke or blood clots.
Yeah.
Specifically. So it's slightly,
like
slightly
aspirin.
Different. Yeah.
Right,
but
right.
can be taken with aspirin. There may be a slight mm-hmm. additive effect, but studies do not suggest mm-hmm. that you're going to bleed uncontrollably with taking natokinase.
Right, right. So in MK7, it's really K2 that's present there, but in the supplement natokinase,
there's some vitamin
K. It's more K1.
Okay.
Yeah, which
yeah.
is more to do with homeostasis. But if you eat the food natto, which
yeah.
is a fermented soy food,
you get K2.
Popular in Japanese cuisine, you could get as much as, I think, 250 micrograms per ounce.
Mm-hmm. Of K2?
Of
K2. K2, right.
Yes, of K2.
Actually, that was,
K2.
There really are, in dietarily, there are two main sources of vitamin K2. One is this Japanese food natto that most Westerners find, you know, too exotic, kind of a acquired taste, maybe repugnant. But a lot of Westerners eat aged cheese, you know, stinky cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really
right.
popular in the Netherlands, which is actually a center of vitamin K research. And they there have coined the term the Dutch paradox, where they consume a ton of cheese. It's actually one of the world's highest per capita cheese
yeah.
consumption mm-hmm. countries, which is, of course, their national pride and joy because they have wonderful cheeses there. But they have actually a surprisingly low rate of heart disease. If you believe that, you know, fat and you know, cholesterol are the end-all and be-all of heart disease risk. And they say that it's because the vitamin K in the cheese can be counteract the risk.
It could be also said that so many in this country are suffering from a vitamin K deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you know one of the reasons why? One is that, you know, people don't have enough fruits and vegetables, which is vitamin K1. They don't consume mm-hmm. the fermented foods that deliver vitamin K2. But also you make
right.
vitamin K in your gastrointestinal tract. And do you know
yeah.
that I actually, before I was really well-schooled in nutrition, there were cases where we found patients who were, say, in the intensive care unit fighting horrible infections, getting multiple antibiotics intravenously, just loaded with antibiotics, who suddenly had bleeding problems. And the reason was that we had killed off the bacteria in their gastrointestinal tracts that synthesized vitamin K. And
oh,
so
wow.
we actually had to give them vitamin K to restore their normal, what we call hemostasis, their ability to prevent hemorrhage. So we'd give them vitamin K injections. It's a little known fact, and it's kind of obscure. It's like, oh, why is this patient bleeding? He shouldn't be bleeding. We don't have him on a blood thinner. We took him off aspirin. And then we discovered that we overdid it with antibiotic treatment. And elderly people are particularly prone to that.
Yeah. Isn't every newborn baby injected with some vitamin K?
Yes, yes. It would to
well,
avoid hemorrhage. There's some
yeah.
kind of, you know, like, I think it's to avoid cerebral hemorrhage. That's actually a little highlight we should look up and discuss at some point here in Intelligent Medicine, why the vitamin K injections in kids.
Yeah. Fascinating. Thank you for your question, Michael. All right. We have a question from Bart. Bart says, people like Barry Sears believe there's no need to cycle supplements because the half-life is so short. That being said, does it make sense to cycle, perhaps take supplements Monday through Friday, and then take the weekend off? Well, I can give one example, Dr. Hoffman, of yep. when it could make sense to do that. Oftentimes in the summer, when a patient or a client has a decent vitamin D level, I will tell them to take a small amount during the week, Monday through Friday, say 2,000 IU, and take the weekend off. And of course, then I would change my recommendation based on a new vitamin D test at the end of summer to see how much they should be taking through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be something like that. But I think for most supplements, I don't see the value in days off, or do you?
Yeah, well, technically, you know, he's a little wrong about the half-life, because, say, your vitamin C and vitamin B, you know, you take it in the morning and you could have, you might have low levels later in the day, especially the water-soluble vitamins. But when it comes to things like when the aforementioned vitamin K, or when it comes to vitamin D and A and E and omega-3 fatty acids, the fat-soluble vitamins, actually, some studies show that it's almost as good to take vitamin D or vitamin A once a month in really high doses rather than, you know, a couple times a day. It's not necessary because it stays in the system. So, but I still, you know, that's just a minor quibble. I agree with Barry Sears that, that would actually speak to another issue. Let's say, for example, somebody's on a blood pressure medication. And, you know, they would need to be on a blood pressure medication. The doctors don't say, okay, take this medication for 6 weeks and then go off for a week and then go back on, because they're afraid that the medication will lose its efficacy. Or similarly, somebody on a psychiatric medication, they don't say, you know, just stay on it, and then we want to make sure it continues to work, so we'll take you off and then we'll put you back on. That could result in a rebound problem. We've actually heard of instances of what's called rebound scurvy. I don't know how often that happens, but people taking high dose vitamin C and they stop suddenly. Maybe their requirements for vitamin C are higher. So I know there's a school of thought that you should rotate your vitamins and kind of freshen up. I'm not sure that that's so applicable.
Right.
You know, right. It actually brings up an interesting discussion, because there is something akin to that with food, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we recommend intermittent fasting.
Yes.
When we tell people sometimes, you know, go easy, you know, or they have like a religious holiday or something, it's actually a benefit, because you stop eating, you rest the body, and something happens. You actually reawaken the immune system. You rest the gastrointestinal tract. You reset your metabolism. And that's why sometimes a little detox, or, you know, we call intermittent fasting, or even just going, you know, 16 hours from, you know, 7 o'clock at night to, 11 o'clock or noon the next morning before you eat, not a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It helps to increase sirtuin, the longevity factor, the gene. It helps with repair processes. Our mitochondria will tend to get bigger because we're burning primarily fat. It's all a good thing.
I actually speak to the issue of caloric restriction in a recent newsletter article that came out last week, so find it at drhoffman.com.
Okay. Oh, okay. I've got a really interesting comment here from Lori, who emailed. She says, I had testing done through Genelex about a decade ago.
Wow.
I was wondering about that too.
Yeah.
She says, I had it done about a decade ago when I repeatedly had unusual side effects trying SSRIs, antidepressants.
Mm, yeah.
The result that I am an intermediate metabolizer has been invaluable in determining safe dosages, understanding side effects, and determining a novel but useful path of treating my depression.
Yes.
Wow. So we use a similar test.
Yeah, well, let's speak to that issue. Is that this is the beginning of the era of what's called personalized medicine. Before, it was like one size fits all. You know, look it up in the PDR. Or maybe they would decide on the basis of a patient's weight or kidney function. You know, people with bad kidney function can't eliminate things, so you have a reduced dose, or, you know, like a pediatric patient would get maybe a quarter of an adult dose, and you kind of just wing it, you know, based on what the studies said was the best dose. But we know that some people are super sensitive to medication, and other people require, you know, more medication than would kill a horse for some reason or another. And that has to do with their, something called a cytochrome P450 system, which is the way that the body detoxifies chemicals.
Yeah.
And it could be chemical toxins, but it's also the way the body detoxifies medication. And some people are fast metabolizers, meaning they need more medication because it breaks down more rapidly. Some people are slow metabolizers, and some people, as she describes, are intermediate metabolizers, so they need less medication. There are also some genes that are beginning to tell us whether people are likely to respond well to one or another psychiatric drug. But I think it's in its infancy, and some of these tests are oversold. It would really be neat if we could give people a blood test, or, you know, have them give a cheek swab, you know, with a like a genetic test to show which medication of the many choices available would be best for their depression or their anxiety or their whatever.
Aren't they doing this in the cancer world? Which chemotherapy would be best? Aren't they determining some of these treatments based on?
Has to do, it's a little different because what I'm talking about is medicines that's based on the person's DNA. You know, right. Like your own personal chemical pathways. And whether you need, you know, you're likely to respond to one or another. There, they're looking at a molecular analysis of the cancer. So it's sort of to decide which pathway in the cancer to block. Because we know that resistant cancers, they tend to circumvent the effects of chemo. So why waste time, you know, firing blanks at a cancer when you can get real, there's a term for this called precision medicine, where you can analyze the tumor, and you can get a really precise idea of which chemo agent or immunotherapy, because now there are immunotherapies that are non-chemotherapies, is most likely to block the cancer or starve the cancer. And that's another form of personalized medicine. I mean, that's really the future. And in fact, my alma mater, Einstein, just built a big institute for molecular medicine, personalized medicine. There was an initiative launched by the Obama administration, which is a big federal funding of a personalized medicine initiative for the 21st century, where they're, you know, which suggests that the new drugs that may be developed will be very, very tailored to individual needs and requirements. Of course, that also means that they're going to be super expensive, because right now it's like, okay, take an aspirin, you know, or take the cancer drugs now cost like five figures and more, you know, high five figures and six figures sometimes for a year of therapy. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm waiting to see if EpiPens move to the black market.
Yeah. Well, you know, just anecdotally, I mean, this is how we experience this crisis, is that at the Hoffman Center, you know, we heard about the way they're gouging EpiPens, and it's terrible for these people with allergies. You know, we as a medical center, we have to have certain emergency equipment present. If a patient has an allergic reaction, or if a patient has, faints, or, you know, so we have an EKG, we have a defibrillator, we have certain medications to revive people, and we have EpiPens. And, you know, 25, 30 years ago when I bought an EpiPen, I don't know, it was probably about, you know, $30, $40, $50. Which was a lot, but it was like within reach. What happens is, you know, I get the nurses, because this is necessary. You got to look at the medications, and they have an expiration date. If, let's say, a medication expires on July 31st, and you have a patient coming into your office, and on August 1st, they have an allergic reaction, and you inject them with the EpiPen, and they die. And so what'll happen is in the discovery on this, they'll say they're investigating. So, well, doc, it sounds like you did everything possible. We just want to, you know, see the records on your medication. Oh, you injected an expired EpiPen. Well, the epinephrine in there one day later did not suddenly turn to water. But for medical legal reasons, we have to throw out perfectly good EpiPens. Actually, I take them home, and just in case somebody visiting my house has an allergic reaction, I keep them. And I know that they're still going to work,
even though they
may be a few months expired. But I've got some sitting in my bathroom at home in case we have an emergency at the house. Somebody gets a bee sting or something and goes into shock. But, from a medical setting, just for professional reasons, we literally have to clear out perfectly good medication, get rid of it, and hospitals and doctor's offices across the country literally have to trash good medication and are forced to buy at exorbitant prices these drugs. And it's really a scam. It's truly a scam.
Okay. Wow.
So on that note...
Yeah.
On that note, let's pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. And in part two, give us a little bit of a tease as to what we're going to tackle.
I'm taking colloidal silver and hydrogen peroxide. Is that good or bad?
Layla, I didn't tell you to take colloidal silver and hydrogen peroxide. You never told me you had a problem. What are you doing? All right, we'll discuss that when we turn.
Okay.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.